Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 71. It's Saturday, July 18th, and I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Thank you for listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 LPFM right here in Toledo. Just for the Health of It aspires to be the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Just for the Health of It has been making public health contagious since 2019. This is the unsanitized report. Well, it's been 2 weeks since my last local, state, and national COVID-19 update. I was out of town visiting family in New York State, so I recorded last week's show early. While we were in New York, the state of Ohio's infection rate got so bad that New York State now requires a 14-day quarantine if you are visiting from Ohio or from any of about 24 different states. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. had just crashed through with record-high new cases. Now, 2 weeks later, things are more than twice as bad, with little signs of slowing, let alone reversing. Nationally, hospitalizations are now setting records, and deaths are showing an inevitable rise with such rates of infections and hospitalizations. In the last 2 weeks, new cases have increased about 40%, and deaths have increased about 50%. Yep, deaths are now actually increasing faster than cases. So much for the theory that high rates among young people is manageable. This more rapid increase in deaths and cases is probably due to testing being jammed up, with people not being able to get a test and many who get a test having to wait many days for this result, for their results. This is the Trump effect. That is, if you don't test, you don't have cases, or more accurately, you don't have cases reported. Of course, the underlying infection and disease still runs its course. The Trump regime may now be trying to manipulate reporting by hospitals. Still, even with delays and potential underreporting, a death is a death, and it comes one way or the other. Given the skyrocketing cases, deaths are likely soon to exceed the worst from the initial wave. This is likely even with somewhat better treatments, particularly since hospital systems are being overwhelmed in many places around the country. No hospital bed, no treatment. No more healthcare providers, no more treatment available. Ohio has now reached a level of cases 4 times that in June, when we leveled the curve. Ohio recently created a color-coded alert system. There are now 19 counties, including Lucas County, under a level 3 advisory, or red, for the spread of COVID-19 in Ohio. These red counties in Ohio hit enough indicators for the spread of coronavirus to trigger a mandatory mask order in public. This means that now more than 60% of the state's population is under a mask mandate. Governor Mike DeWine made a primetime statewide plea to the people of Ohio to wear masks and to stop gathering in large groups, but he stopped short of issuing stronger health orders, such as a statewide mask mandate or reversing business openings. Governor DeWine is joining the stiff competition for the Too Little, Too Late award. His leadership earlier in the epidemic is looking more like red state recalcitrance than a data-driven quest for a healthy Ohio. Well, in Lucas County, in the most recent week, we had 3.5 times the number of new cases compared to 2 weeks earlier. Looks like some Lucas County residents were celebrating their freedom to get infected over the Independence Day holiday. However, there is some good news. Lucas County had 37 active nursing home cases in the most recent week, a continued decline from earlier weeks. Unfortunately, Lucas County and Ohio are running into testing log jams once again, much as the rest of the country. This from WTVG. COVID testing sites backed up in Lucas County. Now that Lucas County has declared a red alert area for COVID, people are trying to get tested for the virus. In many cases, they're having to wait as much as 3 weeks. The Toledo Lucas County Health Commissioner is looking at other options to beef up testing. One of them is asking the Ohio National Guard for help. The immediate need is such that we need to get some additional testing in here, says Eric Gazinski. I know I've talked to the state already about the National Guard coming in and helping us. Gazinski said the wait times at the bigger testing sites are filling up so fast, it's hard to keep up with the need to stem the spread of the virus. It's really difficult to look at contact tracing and containing this virus with these lag times, like they were a couple of months ago, he says. Well, like he says, without widely available testing, with quick results, contact tracing is not feasible, and this makes it very, 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 very difficult to control the virus. Once again, we're playing defense and not well at all. Ohio is performing only about 70% of testing as nationally. Lucas County is performing only about 70% as much as Ohio. Lucas County is performing only about half the testing rate as nationally. Ohio is ranked 41st among states in testing rate. Ohio is ranked 23rd in rate of new infections in the last week. Well, perhaps we can hide out in the middle of the pack and the coronavirus won't notice us.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Well, while your local community may be going down the tubes regarding COVID-19, we can always feel better about some people in some places having it much worse. Case in point, Florida. This from USA Today. Epicenter of the epicenter. Young people partying in Miami Beach despite COVID-19 threat. Florida's record-setting spike in COVID-19 cases hasn't stopped visitors from partying in Miami Beach, which its mayor, Dan Gelber, calls the epicenter of the epicenter. While the fact that Miami is a tourist hotspot is typically a positive, it's exactly the opposite at a time when a city has more than 69,000 cases, the most of any Florida county, and more than twice as much as neighboring Broward, the next on the list. Florida has recorded more than 77,000 cases in the past week alone and over 300,000 in all. The state, all on its own, has more infections than the United Kingdom or Spain. Still, crowds continue to gather on Ocean Drive and on party boats, often promoted on Eventbrite, according to Gelber. Kristen Rosen Gonzalez, a resident of Miami Beach and a former commissioner of Miami Beach, told USA Today that she was on South Beach's iconic Ocean Drive on Monday night as the area started to fill with revelers. "We have this huge party every single night on Ocean Drive," she said, adding that the party has gone on nightly for years, though it originally began as a holiday weekend tradition. "There are throngs of people in the streets with open containers. Nobody is wearing masks. No one is social distancing. No police presence. And it presents a real danger." She said that most attendees are tourists from across the country and noted she spoke to some from New York City and Chicago. Mitch Novick, who owns a Sherbrooke All Suites Hotel, which is situated behind a nightclub, echoed Rosen Gonzalez's concerns about the parties, which both noted have been happening for years. "It's a public safety issue, not just with the risk of coronavirus infection, but with getting shot and stabbed and sexually assaulted all at the same time. The latter of incidents I reference have been going on for years." Novick said he has seen very few people social distancing or wearing masks in the area, which features tight spaces, and called the area a hotbed for infection. "The chaos," which Novick has said happens daily at varying hours, "is brought on by tourists. It's a spring break type of crowd," he said. "Teenagers, 20-somethings, just doing what should not be happening now with this global health crisis." Gelber told USA Today that one statistic stood out during a briefing from the Florida Department of Health highlighting that the parties are part of the problem. "By multiples, the largest group of cases is the 18 to 34 age category in Miami-Dade." He noted that those people are likely infecting family members of other age groups in the area. "That group is the most likely to be ignoring the social distance instructions and are also the ones most likely to get COVID-19 through whatever parties they're having. And that is worrying for another reason. The surge in cases is straining the county's resources. As of today, our county capacity for intensive care patients was 423 beds, and we currently have 438 COVID patients. That means our county is over capacity. But the stats aren't enough to discourage all vacationers. We know there's a pandemic going on, but it's not like you're not going to live your life," Tamia Young, a 36-year-old visiting from Brooklyn, told Reuters. "As a result of the rising cases, Miami-Dade County shut down indoor dining and has imposed a 10 p.m. curfew. The city also put a ban on vacation rentals, including Airbnb," Gelber said. "If these actions don't reverse these upward arcs, then most certainly in a few weeks or less, we'll have to consider more drastic measures," he said in a statement urging people to wear masks. Gelber told USA Today that shutting down Ocean Drive entirely could be on the table. And while authorities have been able to stop some promoted bar parties and may be able to shut down areas of the city, there are other party problems that are less easy to solve. The boats are a big issue. The promoted party boats have expanded dramatically since we've been stopping promoted parties at bars," Gelber explained, referencing the state's late June order that essentially shut down bars again. He noted that some boat parties are organized and others are more impromptu. But the issue of stopping private parties goes beyond the boats. Gelber said it has been tough to enforce social distancing at private parties. "We can't really stop private homes from doing stupid things," he said, noting that they are trying to stop people from violating social distancing rules. "There are clearly too many people who are not even trying. They are actively not complying." Dr. Eileen Marty called the Reading situation extremely grave, warning that the public is not taking this virus seriously enough and ignoring the guidelines DeSantis and others have been pushing. "They have not adhered to guidelines," Marty said at an online news conference with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. "They have been in those closed spaces without taking the appropriate precautions, and that's the main reason we are where we are." Well, there you go. Miami-Dade County doing its part to make Party USA everywhere it can. And for those who aren't in Party USA, this from the Hill. 1,000 inmates at Texas Federal Prison test positive for COVID-19. A North Texas federal prison has more than 1,000 inmates with COVID-19, one of whom has died from the virus, NBC News reports. According to the report, the Federal Correctional Institute at Segoville has 1,798 inmates total, and at least 1,072 have tested positive for coronavirus, According to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the high count makes the Federal Correctional Institute at Segalville home of the largest coronavirus outbreak of any U.S. federal prison. And in other institutional news from MSN, Texas nursing home COVID-19 cases jumped 60% since July 1st. The number of Texas nursing home residents testing positive for COVID-19 has increased by more than 60% since the start of July, according to state data, raising concerns that protective measures still lag in facilities as the new coronavirus infects people across the state at a steep rate. Outbreaks in nursing homes typically follow outbreaks in communities rather than the other way around, said David Grabowski, professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. Even with visitors still barred from skilled nursing facilities, staff can unknowingly bring the virus in and, without adequate precautions, cases can quickly balloon. Another case in point, people, you can't have a bunch of teens and 20-somethings running around getting infected without it ultimately getting around the entire community. People interact with a lot of people, families, older folks, workplaces, and some of those workplaces are prisons and nursing homes, for instance. Okay, well, a couple of weeks ago, I did make a somewhat optimistic prediction that we would see a relatively quick shift to more mask use. This is probably less based on my belief and understanding of human nature than the simple reality that masks are not that difficult compared to the other things we need to do. And the fact is, things get worse, we'll do the lowest hanging fruit. So this from the Hill: masks win political momentum despite GOP holdouts. The political momentum behind mask mandates is growing quickly, with more governors issuing orders that people wear face coverings in public and major retailers uniting behind them. Cloth masks or face coverings are now required in public in about half of the states, but some governors, mostly Republicans, are still resisting calls to issue statewide mandates, leading to a patchwork of rules across the country. Public health experts for several weeks now have pushed for states to issue masking requirements to stop the spread of COVID-19 and help Americans to return to some semblance of normalcy as the search for a vaccine continues. I believe we need a national requirement, but in the absence of that, we need every state to adopt a policy as soon as possible, said Howard Koh, a former health secretary in the Obama administration, adding that uniformity is needed because the virus does not respect city, county, or state borders. We do not have a vaccine until the FDA approves one. Masks are the best vaccine we have, he added. While mounting evidence shows face coverings can stop the spread of COVID-19, governors have been slow to implement requirements. The first states issued mandates in April. 3 months later, half of the states still don't have requirements, but most allow localities to set their own rules, and many have done so. Public health experts argue requirements need to be uniform to be as effective as possible. However, the Trump administration has no plans to issue a federal mandate, and half of the states still have no statewide mandates. We leave it to localities to make the decisions with regard to face coverings, and the CDC guidelines remain the same today, recommended but not required, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said, referring to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. Polls show Americans are gradually coming around to wearing masks in public. A record high 86% of those surveyed in a recent Gallup poll said they wore a mask outside their home in the past 7 days, compared to 64% who said the same in April. CDC Director Robert Redfield this week went as far as saying that the coronavirus crisis could be contained in the next several weeks if everyone in the country would wear masks starting now. I think we are being very clear now, Redfield said during a live stream interview. Now is the time to wear a mask. And in related news from the Hill, Americans want evidence and data to drive COVID decisions. They don't believe that's happening. Americans, it turns out, really like data and want our politicians to use it too. The COVID-19 crisis appears to have prompted a spike in Americans' interest in data. We track daily counts of new coronavirus cases and compare positive results to the number of tests administered. We monitor the share of beds filled in local hospitals. Each Thursday, we wait for the U.S. Department of Labor to report how many people applied for unemployment insurance, and we follow updates on how many loans have been distributed through the Paycheck Protection Program. All told, we are using and monitoring data in an unprecedented fashion. Americans are demanding that policymakers do the same. While there is a clear division in how people are interpreting evidence from epidemiological studies, constituents are nearly united in their belief that politicians should be consulting experts and embracing evidence-based policy. A recent study by NORC at the University of Chicago, commissioned by Results for America, a nonpartisan group with which we are both affiliated, the authors that is, found that 92% of Americans think that policymakers should seek the best evidence and data available when making decisions. Importantly, these results were consistent across party lines. A full 94% of Democrats and 92% of Republicans supported the notion that politicians should make decisions with the best data and evidence. Despite Americans' desire for evidence-based policy, many don't think they're getting it, especially at the federal level. When asked if they thought that President Trump was sufficiently listening to experts to deal with the coronavirus, 59% of respondents, including 28% of Republicans, answered that he isn't. Indeed, state and local policymakers are faring better in the eyes of their constituents. Only 30% said their governor isn't listening to experts enough, and just 31% think the same for their local mayor or local official. As Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo said recently in her state's evidence-based testing and contact tracing efforts, which have sharply reduced the spread of the coronavirus among state residents, if you actually dig into the facts and the data and the science, you realize there's only one solution. There's only one way to do this right. Americans want state government leaders to use evidence even more in their reopening decisions, according to our poll. For example, when asked about states' use of evidence in decisions about reopening schools, 44% said state officials were not using enough evidence, 36% said they were using evidence the right amount, and only 17% said they were using evidence too much. A poll found similar results for state leaders' decisions about reopening retail businesses, 45% not enough evidence, 39% the right amount of evidence, 15% too much evidence. Reopening bars and restaurants, 47% not enough, 36% about the right amount, 16% not too much evidence. And allowing large events such as athletic events or concerts, 44% said we're not using enough evidence, 39% about the right amount, 15% too much. At a time when it seems like our country unites on so few issues, the strong support for the use of evidence and data to drive policy is notable. If evidence and data can help guide us out of this epidemic, let's hope this widespread interest in evidence-based policy endures. Well, unfortunately, in our collective public life, the desire for data and evidence-based policy is not always followed. This from The Hill. Public health groups denounce new Trump move sidelining CDC. The new Trump administration policy that bypasses the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for control of key coronavirus information has provoked outrage among public health experts. Under the policy, quietly announced last week, hospitals are now requiring to report directly to the Department of Health and Human Services on the number of COVID-19 patients each facility is treating, available beds and ventilators, and other data. The CDC has been collecting that information from the start of the pandemic on its National Healthcare Safety Network, which the agency describes as the country's most widely used healthcare-associated infection tracking system. The administration argues the new approach will streamline the compilation of patient data and improve tracking efforts, but experts fear it will harm the quality of the information. They also worry the move is part of a concerted effort to sideline the CDC at a time when President Trump is seeking to deflect blame for his administration's response to the pandemic. Placing medical data collection outside of the leadership of public health experts could severely weaken the quality and availability of data, add an additional burden to already overwhelmed hospitals, and add a new challenge to the U.S. pandemic response, Thomas Feil, Jr., president of the Infectious Disease Society of America, said in a statement. Administration officials said the change is an attempt to modernize a reporting system, but the CDC database was too decentralized because the CDC database was too decentralized and out of date. But the new database called HHS Protects is not public, raising concerns that the data could be manipulated for political purposes. The new HHS database is run by a private contractor called Teletracking, which was awarded a $10 million contract in April. Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the top Democrat on the Senate Health Committee, has raised questions about the firm and the process by which it secured the contract. In June, she asked the CDC for information about the, quote, non-competitive multi-million dollar contract awarded for a duplicative health data system. Murray said the timing of the new decision is also suspect. It's entirely unclear why the Trump administration has asked states and hospitals to upend their reporting system in the middle of a pandemic, in 48 hours nonetheless, without a single explanation as to why this new system is better or necessary. Any move the Trump administration makes regarding the CDC is under a microscope. The administration has effectively silenced the agency during much of the pandemic. Four former CDC directors recently accused the White House of politicizing science and undermining health experts.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-through window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Well, it seems that the Trump administration is deeply committed to no real coordinated federal response other than obfuscating this epidemic. And in that lack of response, we get back to testing again. This from the New York Times. Testing is on the brink of paralysis. That's very bad news. As COVID-19 cases surge to their highest level in dozens of states, the nation's testing effort is on the brink of paralysis because of widespread delays in getting back results. And that is very bad news, because even if testing is robust, the pandemic cannot be controlled without rapid results. This is the latest failure in our national response to the worst pandemic in a century. Since the Trump administration has abdicated responsibility, governors must join forces to meet this threat before the cataclysm that Florida is experiencing becomes the reality across the country. Despite President Trump's boast early this month that testing is, quote, so massive and so good, the United States' two largest commercial testing companies, Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp, have found themselves overwhelmed and unable to return results promptly. Delays averaging a week or longer for all but top priority hospital patients and symptomatic healthcare workers are disastrous to efforts to slow the spread of the virus. Without rapid results, it is impossible to isolate new infections quickly enough to douse flare-ups before they grow. Slow diagnosis incapacitates contact tracing, which entails not only isolating those who test positive, but also alerting the infected person's contacts quickly so they can quarantine too, and avoid exposing others to the virus unwittingly. Among those who waited an absurdly long time for her results was the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms. We finally received our test result taken 8 days before, she tweeted last week. One person in my house was positive then. By the time we tested again 1 week later, three of us had COVID. If we had known sooner, we could have immediately quarantined. Another complaint came this week from Mr. Trump's former acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, who wrote an op-ed commentary for CNBC that my son was tested recently. We had to wait 5 to 7 days for results, noting too that his daughter was told she didn't qualify for a test, he added. That is simply inexcusable at this point in the pandemic. As summer turns to fall, slow and fragmented testing will fatally undermine the reopening of schools and universities, whose plans are predicated on quickly identifying outbreaks and suppressing spread. Testing for millions of students will feed into an already failing national system. Vice President Mike Pence's casual invocation of, quote, an extraordinary national success in testing in a recent call with governors was flatly wrong, as is the president's similar trumpeting of testing success. These claims contribute to a false sense among the public that testing may have had early stumbles but is ramping up slowly but surely. The reality is that the spread of the virus has vastly outpaced the expansion of testing capacity. That spread in turn results in more illness and therefore more tests to process, which further slows down turnaround time in a vicious cycle. The dedication and patience of thousands of people waiting in serpentine lines of cars for hours to be tested are wasted when the results aren't returned quickly enough. I would note that looking at the testing data about how many tests are being done, you look across states and pretty much every state is increasing testing over the last week, yet test results are being delayed even more. We just don't have either the laboratories or the testing reagents or the laboratory personnel, reagents, swabs, you name it. There's all kinds of backups. So here we are, pretty much the same place as we were 2 or 3 months ago. Okay, next up from The Guardian. Coronavirus. World treating symptoms, not cause of pandemic, says United Nations. The world is treating the health and economic symptoms of the coronavirus pandemic, but not the environmental cause, according to the authors of a UN report. As a result, a steady stream of diseases can be expected to jump from animals to humans in coming years, they say. The number of such zoonotic epidemics is rising, from Ebola to SARS to West Nile virus and Rift Valley fever, with the root cause being the destruction of nature by humans and the growing demand for meat, the report says. Even before COVID-19, 2 million people died from zoonotic diseases every year, mostly in poorer countries. The coronavirus outbreak was highly predictable, the expert said. COVID-19 may be the worst, but it is not the first, said the UN Environment Chief Inger Andersen. The biggest economic costs fall on rich nations, $9 trillion for COVID-19 over 2 years, according to the IMF's chief economist. This makes a very good case for investment in the countries where diseases emerge, the authors say. The report said a One Health approach that unites human, animal, and environmental health is vital, including much more surveillance and research on disease threats and the food systems that carry them to people. There has been so much response to COVID-19, but much of it is treated as a medical challenge or an economic shock, said Professor Delia Grace, the lead author of the report by the United Nations Environment Program and the International Livestock Research Institute. But its origins are in the environment, food systems, and animal health. This is a lot like having somebody sick and treating only the symptoms and not treating the underlying cause. And there are many other zoonotic diseases with pandemic potential. An intense surge in human activity is affecting the environment all across the planet, from burgeoning human settlements to food production, to increasing mining industries, said Doreen Robinson, the United Nations Environmental Program Chief of Wildlife. This human activity is breaking down the natural buffer that once protected people from a number of pathogens. It's critically important to get at the root causes. Otherwise, we will consistently just be reacting to things. The science is clear that if we keep exploiting wildlife and destroying our ecosystems, then we can expect to see a steady stream of these diseases jumping from animals to humans in the years ahead, said Andersen. Wildlife and livestock are the source of most viruses infecting humans, and the report cites a series of drivers of outbreaks, including rising demand for animal protein, more intensive and unsustainable farming, greater exploitation of wildlife, surging global travel, and the climate crisis. It also says many farmers, regions, and nations are reluctant to declare outbreaks for fear of damaging trade. The primary risk for future spillover of zoonotic diseases are deforestation of tropical environments and large-scale industrial farming of animals, specifically pigs and chickens at high density, said the disease ecologist Thomas Gillespie of Emory University in the U.S., an expert reviewer of the report. We are at a crisis point. If we don't radically change our attitudes toward the natural world, things are going to get worse, much, much worse. What we are experiencing now will seem mild by comparison. The report highlights some examples of where zoonotic risks are being managed. In Uganda, deaths from Rift Valley fever have been reduced by using satellite data to anticipate heavy rainfall events, which can produce mosquito swarms and trigger outbreaks. The report is the latest stark warning that governments must address the destruction of the natural world to prevent future pandemics. In June, a leading economist in the UN said the coronavirus pandemic was an SOS signal for the entire human enterprise. While in April, the world's leading biodiversity experts said more deadly disease outbreaks were likely unless nature was protected. At the heart of our responses to zoonoses and other challenges humanity faces should be the simple idea that the health of humanity depends on the health of the planet and the health of other species. If humanity gives nature a chance to breathe, it will be our greatest ally as we seek to build a fairer, greener, and safer world for everyone. Okay, well, there's a long-term perspective, people. Take some long-term thinking to actually use prevention. I've been thinking in recent weeks, feeling like I'm just sitting around waiting for primates to develop abstract reasoning, and I realize that it's actually not abstract reasoning itself that's the bottleneck in all of this. I would call it more emotional fortitude, that is the ability to see through goals, to sustain disciplines, and to set boundaries that are healthy for ourselves and the planet. To get a little bit at that, kind of the psychology behind that, here is an article from Stat News. Why we are so late responding to COVID-19. Blame it on our culture and brains. From the recent rise in COVID-19 cases linked to reopening in states across the country, to the models showing that shutting down the country even 2 weeks earlier would have saved almost 55,000 lives, this pandemic is shining a spotlight on our inability to act early and preventively. It reminds me of the fable about the ant and the grasshopper. In it, the ant works prudently all summer and is prepared when winter hits, while the grasshopper lives it up during times of warmth and abundance, only to suffer when things freeze up. Why are humans like grasshoppers, frequently not seeing the need to act until it's too late? Part of the answer lies in how our cultural and cognitive systems work. Our brains are programmed to prioritize the present and undervalue the future. Our psychology has evolved to make us good at thinking about immediate exchanges and benefits, but we have difficulty getting behind approaches that require us to do something now so nothing bad happens in the future. Even though contagious outbreaks have occurred in the past, and despite exhortations from public health experts that they would happen again, we lack the systems and mindsets to proactively respond to COVID-19. The lack of public will and demand for prevention makes it difficult for policymakers to build prevention into our public health systems and institutions. It's easy for elected officials to win favor by putting out small fires or building infrastructure that improves people's lives in tangible ways, things like new roads or faster broadband. But it's hard to win elections by using valuable public resources so nothing bad happens. But if we don't demand prevention, we are unlikely to get public health systems that deliver it. People are not willfully illogical in not getting behind these solutions. It's just that our brains and culture get in the way. Psychological mechanisms like delay discounting, the tendency to take less now than the promise of more later, and normalcy bias, a cognitive response that pushes us to think that the future will be the same as the present, make it hard for our brains to process prevention arguments. Normalcy bias in particular is a barrier to preparing for disasters. There are also cultural factors that make prevention a hard sell. Declinism is the belief that, compared to the present, the future is destined to be a dismal place. It is connected to fatalism, the belief that nothing can be done because problems are too deep and numerous. These two features of our common culture allow us to disengage from the abstract thinking needed to act preventively. If the future is destined to be dark, why bother being proactive? Our culture's strong sense of individualism also works against our ability to think preventively. We can see how making better individual choices and exercising willpower might prevent a problem, but struggle to see how changing systems can keep bad things from happening. The COVID-19 coverage, with its focus on individual behavior and heroic actors, has strengthened our sense of individualism and pushed systems-level prevention further out of mind. But the good news for public health is that there are ways to short-circuit these psychological processes and shift culture to broaden support for prevention. For example, messages that connect actions now with outcomes later, as the field of early childhood has done successfully, bolster support for preventive actions. Values that activate legacy thinking, the desire to leave something positive behind for future generations, are also effective in getting people to see the importance of doing something now for future benefits, and making sure that messages balance a focus on the urgency of the problem with the presence and power of solutions also make people more supportive of prevention. One of the most powerful ways of building support for prevention is having an example of its importance that people personally connect with. This is exactly what we're in the midst now. The pandemic is affecting our lives in ways that allow us to feel why it is so important to have robust preventive systems in place. This could create the kind of demand for prevention that policymakers can't ignore. Hopefully, it results in a more prevention-oriented and equitable public health system. It could also increase our demand for prevention on other issues, leading to better mental health services, more proactive child protection systems, more affordable housing, and even more demand for action on climate change. A cognitive perspective puts a different spin on the ant and the grasshopper fable. Maybe the grasshopper isn't lazy or hedonistic. Maybe it has a cognitive system like ours, one engineered for the here and now. The COVID-19 pandemic might be a big enough wrench to bring our cognitive systems to a grinding halt, allowing us to see and prepare for the next winter. Okay, well, next up we have a story that gets at this whole myth that's been going on for months that, well, maybe the summer it'll go away or be a lot less. So this from The Hill, the coronavirus climate air conditioning nexus. This summer, America will be hemmed in by a climate emergency on one hand and a continuing deadly pandemic on the other. Meanwhile, humming away in the background, aggravating our plight, will be that long-time summer friend, air conditioning. Climatic models are projecting that heat waves will be more frequent and more intense than usual across the United States this summer. As pandemic-induced restrictions are relaxed, severe heat likely will drive most social gatherings and group activities into the air-conditioned indoor world. There, the risk of coronavirus spread will be much higher than it is in a park or on a porch. These days, it's always riskier to gather indoors than outdoors. Research says that indoor spaces can be made somewhat safer simply by opening windows for ample ventilation. That won't work in air-conditioned buildings, which must be zipped up tight. Air conditioning raises the risk further by lowering the indoor relative humidity. Studies show that coronaviruses in general, including those that cause the common cold, SARS, and MERS, remain viable and infective longer when humidity is low, whether the viruses are in the air or on surfaces. There's more. When humidity is high, virus particles are carried inside bulky saliva droplets that fall to the floor or other surfaces within seconds. But with low humidity, they are in much smaller droplets called aerosols that stay airborne far longer, ready to be inhaled. Some types of cooling systems also serve to circulate droplets very efficiently and potentially could infect large numbers of people. A widely cited case study found that in January, one customer at a restaurant in Guangzhou, China, infected 9 other diners sitting at 3 different tables with COVID-19. The breeze from an air conditioner near one of the tables had efficiently distributed virus-laden droplets along a 20-foot-long path. There are numerous cases in which air conditioning has caused health problems by spreading bacteria and mold spores, which can be associated with so-called sick building syndrome. Studies in North and South America and Europe have found that people employed in air-conditioned workplaces generally have more health problems than those who work in non-cooled spaces. Despite such impacts, air conditioning is customarily viewed as a net health benefit because it can help prevent death during heat waves. However, research shows that when people die of heat stress, it is largely because they are living in marginalized, economically stressed urban areas with too much concrete and too little vegetation, often in communities of color who have inadequate access to services, especially healthcare. Those who die in a heat wave also are often elderly or have pre-existing health problems, and they may be unable to afford electricity to run an air conditioner. Not coincidentally, these communities and individuals who are most vulnerable to heat waves are also the most vulnerable to the coronavirus. To be clear, air conditioning indeed can help keep people alive under harsh conditions, and that is no small thing. Nevertheless, it is important for us to acknowledge that in that role, the air conditioner is an in-case-of-emergency break-glass tool. It's not designed to fix underlying social and economic injustices from which people need to be rescued, whether it's from extreme heat or a viral pandemic. Air conditioning increasingly is viewed as an adaptation to climate change, but it also accelerates greenhouse warming. It accounts for 17% of year-round home electricity consumption and the resulting emissions. Furthermore, the Energy Information Agency predicts that U.S. energy use for air conditioning will grow faster than any other use of energy in buildings of all kinds in coming decades. The chain of causation forms a perfect circle. Greenhouse emissions from past decades, including billions of tons of carbon dioxide emitted by air conditioning, aircraft, and other technology that also happen to be implicated in the pandemic, may make this summer the hottest ever, prompting even more air conditioning use, which will further increase greenhouse emissions. Those emissions will help ensure that future summers are even hotter and future air conditioning systems are pushed even harder. I believe that ending the climate emergency will require the rapid, mandatory reduction of fossil fuel use to zero and a complete overhaul of our built environment, including good, affordable housing and a healthy environment for all. Meanwhile, we at least can curb the short-term damage. Home air conditioning should be turned off on those many summer days when shade and fans can provide sufficient comfort. Offices should never be so frigid that workers resort to wearing sweaters or keeping space heaters under their desks in July. Every building should have windows that can be opened and that stay open as much as possible. And at least for the rest of the summer, let's all get together outdoors. And in a somewhat related story from Nature magazine, this gets at the whole nexus between our culture, technology, sustainability. And the title is, I'm just going to read actually a very small portion, kind of an abstract of this article, but it's a really good article. So if you want to read it in depth, you can go to nature.com and look for the article called Scientists' Warning on Affluence. Here we go. For over half a century, worldwide growth in affluence has continuously increased resource use and pollutant emissions far more rapidly than these have been reduced through better technology. The affluent citizens of the world are responsible for most environmental impacts and are central to any further prospect of retreating to safer environmental conditions. We summarize the evidence and present possible solutions approaches. Any transition towards sustainability can only be effective if far-reaching lifestyle changes complement technological advancements. However, existing societies, economies, and cultures incite consumption, expansion, and the structural imperative for growth in competitive market economies inhibits necessary societal change. What do you say, folks? Revolution, anyone? Okay, I want to close the show with several short stories on some other things that aren't entirely dominated by COVID-19. This from Science Daily. Half of the world's population exposed to increasing air pollution. Half of the world's population exposed to increasing air pollution, new research has shown. A team of researchers led by Professor Gavin Shattuck at the University of Exeter has shown that, despite global efforts to improve air quality, vast swaths of the world's population are experiencing increased levels of air pollution. The study, carried out with the World Health Organization, suggests that air pollution constitutes a major and in many areas increasing threat to public health. The World Health Organization has estimated that more than 4 million deaths annually can be attributed to outdoor air pollution. Although air pollution affects high and low-income countries alike, low and middle-income countries experience the highest burden, with the highest concentration seen in Central, Eastern, Southern, and Southeastern Asia. Okay. Next up from the New York Times, in shadow of pandemic, U.S. drug overdose deaths resurge to record. Drug deaths in America, which fell for the first time in 25 years in 2018, rose to record numbers in 2019 and are continuing to climb, a resurgence that is being complicated and perhaps worsened by the coronavirus pandemic. Nearly 72,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year, according to preliminary data released Wednesday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an increase of 5% from 2018. Deaths from drug overdoses remain higher than the peak yearly death totals ever recorded for car accidents, guns, or AIDS, and their acceleration in recent years has pushed down overall life expectancy in the United States. It looks as if 2020 will be even worse. Drug deaths have risen an average of 13% so far this year over last year, according to mortality data from local and state governments collected by the New York Times, covering 40% of the U.S. population. If this trend continues for the rest of the year, it will be the sharpest increase in annual drug deaths since 2016, when a class of synthetic opioids known as fentanyls first made significant inroads in the country's illicit drug supply. The 2018 decline was largely explained by reductions in deaths from prescription opioid medications, the drugs that started the nation's addiction epidemic back in the 1990s. But those declines appear to have been overrun by continued increases in deaths from illicit drugs, particularly methamphetamine, cocaine, and fentanyl. And lastly, lest we forget that racism is present in medicine and public health, This from Stat News. A years-long push to remove racist bias from kidney testing gains new ground. For years, physicians and medical students, many of them black, have warned that the most widely used kidney test, the results of which are based on race, is racist and dangerously inaccurate. Their appeals are gaining new traction, with a wave of petitions and papers calling renewed attention to the issue. In recent weeks, physicians and medical students at a handful of prominent universities have called on their administrations to end the use of race-based kidney testing, pointing to such changes at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in 2017 and at Mass General Brigham and the University of Washington earlier this summer. On the heels of those petitions, as well as widely circulated New England Journal of Medicine analysis of the kidney test and other medical tools that are biased against black patients, the National Kidney Foundation and the American Society of Nephrology announced this month that they will convene a task force to evaluate the use of race in kidney testing. Science has been a conspirator of racism since the genesis of racism, and it is our duty as physicians to be keenly aware and critical of that history and how we still operate within it despite our best intentions, said Paloma Scott, a medical student who co-authored a petition to Mount Sinai calling to end the use of race as a factor in the test. The test, which measure what's known as estimated glomerular filtration rate, or EGFR, has historically considered four factors: age, gender, race, and levels of creatinine, the waste that kidneys filter out of blood. But the race of a patient can only be bucketed into two groups, black or not black. That's based on a flawed assumption that dates back to the formula's creation, when medical experts presumed that black people have higher muscle mass on average, leading to higher kidney function. Normal adult kidney function, around or above a score of 90, while patients can be added to the kidney transplant waitlist once they hit 20 or below, patients who are black automatically have points added to their score, which can make results appear more normal than they might be, which in turn could delay needed treatment. It's unclear how widespread the changes will be and whether national organizations will take on the cause. The National Kidney Foundation declined to comment on the EGFR testing. The press release announcing its task force acknowledges that race is a social construct and not a biological one, but makes no definitive statements on changing the test, only on examining it. Well, folks, sexism, racism, capitalism are all alive and well. Maybe we should have a little more mortality on that front for those things.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning: use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, I'll end the show on that note. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up this show to re-listen to it, look at old shows, listen to old shows, or queue up future shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or you can go to Facebook and like the show's Facebook page at facebook.com/justforhealthwakt, where the four is the number four, not the word four. Just for Health WAKT is the Facebook page. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.